In the second chapter, we were talking about the different ways in which words express their meanings. Basically, three kinds of meaning: literal meaning, called the Abhidhavritti, or Sakshad, direct. For example, if we refer to the village on the Ganga, Gangayam Goshaha, there is a direct reference. There's a literal meaning to the words. Without a literal meaning, there can't be additional meanings. The metaphorical meaning and the suggested meaning cannot even come into existence without the literal meaning being there first.
Can we turn on one fan?
We're going to start the third chapter. I'm just giving a general summary now. When I say, and I refer to a village on the Ganga, the words have a literal meaning. The word Ganga is the name of a river. That is understood by convention. As a name, all names are assigned by convention. Even if a name has a derivational meaning, the conventional meaning is primary. It's just somebody's name. This is the name of a particular river that's located in a particular place. And the other term, Goshaha, and also it's in the, you know, Saptami Vibhakti, expressing the adhikaran of the location. So the Ganga is being expressed as the location. In that location, on the Ganga, is a village, Goshaha, and Bhavati verb is implied. So the term Goshaha, it actually can mean a few things. It can mean sound, an inarticulate sound. The word Gosha can mean a rich person, and it can mean a cowherd village. Actually, Kavi Karnapur has looked at two different interpretations. One is that there's a rich man on the Ganga, but we'll look at the other one. There's a village, a cowherd village on the Ganga. The literal meaning is there. The words have their literal meaning. But there's some problem in construing that meaning, that there's a logical impossibility. In the real world, you don't have villages, in the ordinary world, you don't have villages on top of bodies of water. Villages don't float on water. So there's something wrong there. The literal meaning, although the literal meaning exists, it's absurd. It's blocked by its conflict with reality as we know it. It's scientifically unfeasible. So we have to resort, when there's a blockage, a problem with the literal meaning, we have to resort to the secondary meaning, to the second level of meaning, to lakshana. Lakshana can be by similarity or by any other relationship. Actually, it's stronger when it's by other relationships. Similarity is the weakest relationship. But here we have a connection of proximity. Next to the river is the river bank. And it can be scientifically, literally understood that there's a village on the shore of the river. It's close to the river, within a few hundred yards of the river. So that way we're using lakshana vritti to say village on the Ganga, where we really mean village on the shore that's connected to the Ganga. It's lakshana vritti by proximity. But if we're speaking poetically, then the meaning can be carried to a third dimension, and that is the suggested meaning. In ordinary speech, in day-to-day speech, we resort to metaphor all the time. We're walking down the street, and we call people, this person's an ass, and that's a donkey, and that's a dog. And we get angry at people and call them names. That's all use of lakshanavritti. The man is not a dog, he's not a pig, he's not a jackass, he's a human being. But we metaphorically, in our anger, call these people all these names. So we're using metaphor all the time. We can hardly put a sentence together in real life without resorting to lakshanavritti about something. So many of the words we actually use, the phrases we actually use, are resorting to less than to non-literal meaning. But that's not poetry. Walking down the street and calling people names is not poetry. For that, we have to go to the third dimension, suggested meaning. And if used by a poet, the phrase in a properly produced poem, the phrase "village on the Ganga" can express the suggested meaning. It depends on the intention of the author and the expertise of his composition, but the phrase can express the unspoken fact about the village is that it's a sacred village. The climate is cool because it's next to the river. These things are implied. The sacredness and the coolness of the atmosphere is implied by the proximity to the river. So that is the suggested meaning about the village. It's a sacred village with a cool climate. That's a use of vyanjanavritti or dwani suggested. Dwani is essential to poetry. It's what really differentiates poetry from prose. Not meter, not style, but dwani is the life of poetry. There's the metaphor of the kavya purusha, the personality of poetry. The heart, the soul of the kavya purusha is rasa. That not all mundane poets understand. Mundane poets, materialistic poets, don't understand the transcendental essence of rasa. They just understand it as material emotions, perverted rasas. And they write poems about ordinary people and their ordinary emotions. And it's hard for a materialist to understand how these emotions are the essence of life, because material emotions don't have the same value as spiritual emotions. They're near rasa. There's no rasa in material, real rasa in material emotions. And therefore, there's no real rasa, there's no real life in material poetry, even by the greatest, most expert and renowned poets. If it's not about Krishna and his devotees, then it's nirasa. There's no rasa there. There's no real taste. So rasa is the real soul of poetry, but that's only recognized by the rasikas, the devotees. The mundane poets talk about rasa, but they don't know what it is. And therefore they cannot value its true importance. So some early theorist of poetry identified something other than rasa as the essence of poetry. Style, or vakrokti, which means twisted language, the unusual use of language. Some say that's the essence of poetry. But beginning with the authority Anandakara, Anandavardhana, he wrote the Dvanya. What did he write? What's the name of this book? Dvanya Loka was written by him? Okay, he wrote the textbook that presented the Dvani theory, that the essence of poetry is Dvani, or suggestion. But we take that one step further. Our Vaishnavacharyas, who are authorities on poetry, distinguish that Dvani is not really the soul of poetry, it's the prana of poetry, the asu, the life air. And dvani is of prime importance because it expresses rasa. Rasa is the real soul. And dvani is the vital air that expresses, that the soul expresses itself through. So dvani is a very important. It was discussed in the second chapter, but because dvani is the very life air of poetry, It gets its own chapter for further discussion here in the third chapter. The power of suggestion that is present in any real poetry. As far as rasa goes, that's discussed, I think, in the fifth chapter. There's a long discussion of the different components and the different workings of rasa. We've already familiar with that from Bhaktivinoda Sindhu, and similar discussion is given here in the Alankara Kaustubha, as also you'll find in the Bhakti Sandarbha, or rather the Bhakti and Preeti Sandarbha of Jiva Goswami, especially Preeti Sandarbha. Here we focus in the third chapter on how dvani actually works and the different varieties of dvani, different subcategories. He actually breaks it up. By the end of the chapter, he's enumerating hundreds of thousands of different varieties of dvani. He actually mathematically makes a count of, you know, into the six digits, even millions of different kinds of dvani. So we start from the beginning. What is the proper definition of dvani? I'm using the term dvani. It means suggestion. Same thing as vyanjana. So, grammatically, the word could be understood in different senses. So, in the Karika, Kavi Karnapur gives his definition of dvani. Shabd art adi bir anyais cha dvanyate sav iti dvani hi. Dvani is that which is suggested, which is expressed by echoing, dvanyate, by shabda arta and so on, and also by other factors. Of course, this is, dvanyate is karmani prayoga, so the shabda, the arta, and the other things, they're all the subject of the verb. These things express dvani, or reverberate and create dvani. That is dvani. What is created by the reverberation, by the echo? That is what we call karma vachaka. In other words, we're interpreting the word dvani as expressing the object. It's the thing that's done. Just like eating, or rather, let's say, speech, vacha. Now, what does vacha mean? Vacha could mean the act of speaking. It could mean by which the faculty by which you speak, the speaking faculty, your tongue and your brain and your lungs, your lips, this could be called vacha maybe. But another meaning of vacha would mean what is spoken, the product of speech, the words, the ideas. That's another meaning of vacha. Thus, vang also means literature. It means the production of the karma, the product of the act of speaking. So here we're defining dvani as the product of the act of reverberation, of suggestion. That which is suggested, that which is produced, the meaning that is produced by the power of suggestion, that's what we call dvani. That's karma vachaka. It's expressing the karma, the result, product, or the object of the action. This is an action of production, so the product is the karma. Now, there are other possible ways to read the word dvani. You could say that dvananam is dvani. Dvananam would be the act itself of of echoing. The act of suggesting could be called dvani. Dvanyate nena dvani. That by which suggestion is done could be called dvani, the instrument of suggestion. Or dvanyate asmin, the location of the act of suggestion. It could be bhavavachaka, expressing the act itself. It could be karanavachaka, expressing the instrument, the means. It could be even Adhikarana Vachaka, expressing the location. But, and the word Dhwani sometimes is used in those senses, in other contexts. But in order to exclude these possibilities, Kavi Karnapur is given a specific definition that it, no, it's karma vachaka. It's what is expressed by suggestion. What is produced, the meaning that is produced by the power of suggestion, that's what he wants to call Dhwani. Now, if we allowed bhava-vachaka, if we allowed dhwani to be expressing the act of suggesting, then, let's see, even one's awareness about the meaning of a dhwani, just like I'm the commentator, and I say that, let's see if I have this right. Okay, I'm the person reading the commentary, and I get from the commentary the understanding that Gangayam Gosha suggests the sanctity and the coolness of the village. I have an awareness of that. But if the act itself of echoing, of suggesting, is what Dhwani is, then even just my theoretical understanding about it is all, would have to also be called Dhwani. There's an act of suggesting there. So not only the poetry, but even just my mundane, my scholarly, you know, study of the poetry would also be suggestion. It's not. But it, if I let Dhwani mean just the act of suggesting, then it would be. Or if Dhwani could be the instrument. Dhwanyate anena karana sadhanam, dhwani karane kavye, then poetry is the instrument of suggestion. You use poetry. You use the verses in a poem. A poet uses his verses to express various suggestions. And he suggests rasa by his poems, by the words and the verses that compose his poetry. If dhwani meant that by which there is suggestion, the current of vachaka, then the poetry itself, just the verses and the words, would be dhwani. That's not what we want. We don't want the poetry to be the dhwani, the poems, or dhwanyate asmin, the adhikarana vachaka, the dhwani is the location of the suggestion. Then the person who listens to the poetry and recognizes the suggestion would be located in him, and he would be the dhwani. Then the hearer would be dhwani. Or the author would also be the dhwani. We don't want dhwani to mean that. So we settle on, so excluding all these other possibilities, we settle on karma vachaka. The dhwani is what is produced by the power, the idea in the heart of the hearer that is produced by the power of suggestion. Yeah.
Can I try to recap to see if I understand?
Yes.
Is that dhwani is that which is vibrated by the meaning of words in others?
Let's, you know, there's these different words, echo, vibrate. Let's be specific and concrete and say suggested.
So
use the verb suggested.
Dhwanyate means suggested.
Well, let's use the verb suggest rather than echo.
Okay, okay.
Echoing and reverberating, they're sort of little, you know, sort of vague in application to poetry.
So vani is that which is suggested by the meaning of words in other things, not the suggesting, not that by which things are suggested, or not that in which the things are suggested.
Yes. But it's what gets suggested. What is it that gets suggested is peculiar kinds of ideas, meaning. What's suggested by Dwani is some sort of meaning. There's different kinds of meaning, and we'll have subcategories, but basically it's meaning that's suggested. It's what's suggested is not a flower or a rock falling on your head. It's an idea in your mind. That's what gets suggested.
Can you explain the Dvanyatismin again? The location, why it's not like...
Well, location, you know, locations can be... A location can be in the subject or in the object. So when a poet is writing poetry that makes suggestion, the suggestion is located in him as the subject, as the doer of the suggesting. And the listener, he's receiving the suggestion. It's located in him too. It's being suggested to him, indirect object. So it can be said to be located in the author or in the audience, the suggestion. That's where it resides. It starts in the author. He expresses it, and it's conveyed to the audience who receive it, and it's located in them, in their minds. So then Dwani could mean the author or the audience, if it was the location.
It would make it subjective, that the Dwani, because the Dwani should be something objective that everybody can understand, not something subjective that people can interpret.
Well, here we're identifying not just... We're not making it subjective. Something, it is the subject. If we let Dwani be the location is the subject and the object. You know, it's not only something that is whatever the author or the hearer imagined it to be. The problem is now we're letting it be the author and the hearer. It actually, you know, if it's Adhikarana Vachaka, what's the Adhikarana? The author and the audience. So they are the Dwani, according to that interpretation. It's not appropriate. We don't want Dwani to mean that. We don't want Dwani to mean just the poetry. It's something special in the poetry. We don't want Dwani to be the active suggestion. We want to focus our interest on, our attention on what it is, what meaning is produced by Dwani. We're interested in Dwani because of what it does, what it produces. It evokes rasa. Beside other things, the most important thing that Dwani does is awaken a realization of rasa that can't be realized other ways. So it's the result, it's the realization of rasa that we're interested in, not the technique of how it's done. We're interested in what gets done. And then we show interest in the technique only because we're really interested in the result. We're not interested in fancy use of language just for its own sake. We're interested in how it produces realization of rasa. Okay, now, if what Dwani is, according to our definition, it's the thing, it's the meaning that's created by suggestion, what is that meaning? What is it, a special kind of meaning? Can we distinguish it from other meanings? Because there's so many ideas. Not all of them should be called Dwani. Which particular kinds of meanings are Dwanis? Could be products of suggestion. What kind of meanings does suggestion produce? So that's listed here in the next karika. Raso bhavas tata baso vastalankara evaja bhavanam udayak shantik sandik shabalayata tata sarvam janis tadjanitve kavyam cha dvanir uchyate. These are the different kinds of meanings that could be dvani. Rasa is first on the list. Then bhava the ecstasies that are the components of rasa. Now you have tadabhasa. Tadabhasa, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentary, is rasabhasa and bhavabhasa. The shadow, perverted reflections of rasa and of bhava. When there's inappropriate mixture of bhavas, then you get rasabhasa. And then even each bhava could be improperly constituted, and you have bhavabhasa, perverted bhavas. They're also expressed, if there's any reason to express them, they're expressed by dhvani. Bad poetry does a lot of expressing of rasabhasa and bhavabhasa. That's bad poetry. But even good poetry sometimes will intentionally use some discordance for a particular purpose. Like music can have, you know, dissonance in it, but it serves a harmonious purpose. So sometimes a little bit of rasabhasa actually is appropriate in poetry when it's used expertly. Yeah, abhasa, reflection, but reflection in the sense of perverted form or shadow. Then vastu and alankara, these are very important, the more ordinary but very common products of dhvani are vastu and alankara. It's very hard to analyze how the actual mechanics, the dynamics of the expression of rasa, that's beyond analysis. But we can analyze how these more ordinary products of dhvani come about. And there's a lot of analysis of this. Of vastu and alankara, these two different kinds of dhvani. Vastu is simply means subject, an object. But in the poetic context, it means the storyline, the story, the plot. You know, or just the literal meaning. You know, the story, let's say. So the vastu can be suggested by dhvani. Or actually it is the dhvani, but it's suggested by the power of the dhvani shakti. We'll see many examples of this. This will be analyzed in this chapter. And sometimes alankaras can be suggested. We haven't studied alankaras yet. The ornaments of speech, ornaments of poetry, two kinds. The ornaments of sound and the ornaments of meaning. Just like alliteration, you know, using the same phoneme over and over again, pa 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 pa, you know, repeating it many times in a poem. You see that in the Bhagavatam a lot. That is a shabdalankara, one kind of ornament of speech, and it sometimes has special psychological effects. It expresses certain moods when you use different kinds of alliteration. There are heroic alliterations and there's charming alliterations, different sounds that have different effects. And then there are many artha alankaras, figures of speech based on not the sound, but the meaning. Just like metaphors and similes and exaggerations and so on. These are artha alankaras. So there are ways to create alankaras by the way you use words, but you can also create alankaras just by suggestion. This is a little subtle, but we'll see examples of it later. Of dhvani, the result of a dhvani being the expression of an alankara. So either the story, the actual message, let's say message. The message or an alankara can be the result of the dwananam, of the suggestion. Yes, Guru?
This is the different types of dvanis.
Yes.
A dvani can suggest rasa, a dvani can suggest bhava.
Well, we just said the dvani is what suggests, so let's not say the dvani does the suggestion.
Okay, yes.
Let's say the power of suggestion, but let's leave the word dvani for the product.
Okay. So now, these are dvanis. There's the rasa dvani, the bhava dvani.
Yes. And then also more. Bhavas have various stages that they go through. There's the udaya, or the manifestation of a bhava when it becomes visible. You know, it just comes into focus. That's called the bhava udaya. And the shanti, when a bhava dissipates, when it goes out of focus, that's the bhava shanti. And you can mix bhavas. And there's two different ways to mix bhavas. They can be complementary, where they're equal. That's bhava sandhi. Or bhava shabalata is when one bhava predominates over another one, and the second one is just minor bhava in relationship to the major bhava. That's shabalata. So all of these can be expressed as dhwanis, can be suggested. You can suggest these various kinds of permutations and combinations of bhavas. All of this is called dhwani, and then one more thing is called dhwani, and that's the poetry itself, which is metaphorically called dhwani, because the dhwani is born in the poetry. The dhwani comes from the poetry, so the poetry can, in a metaphorical sense, in a figurative sense, also be called dhwani. Yeah.
Just recorded.
Do we understand that when he says a kavyam shadvani ruchyate, then Kavya Karnapur departs from his own definition of dhvani as karma sadhana? Because then kavya is kartri or karta of dhvani. It's a
kavya is the karana.
Is it? Oh, the karana. Okay.
The suggesting is being done by the poetry.
Okay, the karana then, but still it's
so
parts.
Yes. What he's saying is we just ruled it out in our strict definition, but anyway, figuratively we can also call it dhwani. Figuratively.
That's the only exception he takes.
It's called dhwani. It's not really dhwani according to the strict definition, our own definition. But we're going to use it that way anyway.
Okay, that's the only
figuratively.
Exception.
We'll take the liberty of calling it dhwani also.
That's the only exception, right, she uses throughout the book.
The only exception, well, I don't know. Right now it's the only exception he's acknowledging. Maybe he's going to even take more liberties later. We can look out for that. Actually, the other dhwanis are the life, the dhwani that's rasa, that dhwani is the real soul of poetry. The other dhwanis are the pranas. When we talked about the Kavya Purusha, we said that rasa is a soul. So even though rasa is a dhwani, it's not only a prana like the other dhwanis. Rasa is the atma of poetry. The other dhwanis are the pranas.
How many life airs is there in the body? Is there 10 life airs?
Yes.
There is 10 life airs. So it says that the dhwani are the life airs, and if you count this, there's 10 types of dhwanis.
But did you count rasa?
Yes.
But we just said rasa is not one of the pranas.
Oh, oops.
Rasa is the atma. Okay, we're going to talk about all of these later. Actually, rasa and bhava will be discussed in the 5th chapter. So you won't hear about them in the 3rd chapter. They're not analyzable in the same way. The workings of rasa and bhava are much too complex to subject to this analysis. Okay, you count kavya as the 10th. Yes. I mean, there are minor, some of the pranas are minor. Yes. Well, wait a second. We have two different conversations going on. No? Okay. Could you give the microphone?
So we told that we're not going to analyze rasa and bhava, but what about...
We will. In the fifth chapter, discussion will be there.
Yes,
but
yes.
But we can't cut it up into categories. It's too complex.
Uh-huh. And what about tata bhasa, like rasa bhasa and bhava bhasa? Will we discuss it after rasa and after bhava?
They will also be discussed in the fifth chapter.
Fifth chapter also.
Yeah. Okay. Because wait a minute. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah.
There is discussion of how they're suggested. I don't remember which chapter it occurs in. I don't remember.
Yeah, because we cannot speak about these things like perverted rasas and bhavas unless we understood what is real rasa and real bhava.
Yes, so I think first rasa and bhava, rasa is defined in detail. Then we talk about the different functions of bhava, yes. Okay. Okay. Now these other dvanis that are the pranas, that means leaving out rasa, actually leaving out rasa and bhava and all the and other functions of rasa and bhava, that actually only leaves us vastu and alankar. If rasa, bhava, and all the components of the bhavas and all the functions of the bhavas are left out of the question, because they're really, rasa and bhava are really in the category of prana, of atma. The prana bhuta, anyway, I guess, okay, I'm sorry. Just exclude rasa. Bhava can be included. These are the pranas. Now we can talk about the subdivision of these dvanis, which are the pranas, the life airs of poetry. There are two kinds of dvani, abhida mula and lakshana mula. Mula means root. There's dvani that has its root in literal meaning, and dvani that has its root in secondary meaning, figurative meaning. Lakshana vritti. There's a distinction between the two. There's the first one is avivakshita vachya, and the other is vakshita vachya. Vachya means the literal meaning. Vachya, of course, means to be expressed, but in poetry, we understand that to mean what is literally expressed. What is the vachya artha is the literal meaning. And then the lakshita artha is the secondary meaning. And the vyanjita artha is the tertiary meaning. By vachya artha, we mean the literal, first, primary meaning. So avivakshita vachya means when you have lakshana mula, when you have dvani that is rooted in secondary meaning, in figurative meaning, burning? Okay. When you have dvani, suggestion that's rooted in figurative meaning, then the literal meaning is not intended to be expressed. It's avivakshita vachya. You're not, it's the speaker is not meaning to state the literal idea when he's using suggestion that's based on figurative usage. But when he's using suggestion that's based on literal meaning, then the literal meaning is meant to be expressed. And something's added to it. We'll see this, what this all means when we look at the examples.
This is avivikshita.
Avivakshita.
Avivakshita.
This is the past participle of the desiderative. You vivakshiti means he wants to say. Vivakshita is what is wanted to be said. In other words, the author's intention. So avivakshita means not intended by the person who's speaking. You know, when I say you're an ass, I don't mean literally that you have four legs. I don't mean to say that literally. So I'm using figurative language, and therefore I don't mean the literal idea. That's avivakshita vachya. The ancha means the ancha is the second of the two. We have two, abhida mula and lakshana mula. So the second one, lakshana mula, is avivakshita vachya. And when you have suggestion that's based on figurative usage, the speaker doesn't mean to say to express the literal meaning. But when you have the first kind, the abhida mula, the suggestion that's based on literal meaning, then he does mean to express the literal meaning. The literal meaning is not lost when we have abhida, mula, vyanjana, or dvani. But it is lost or distorted when we have lakshana, mula. We'll see the examples of this. This can also be understood in a different way. We were talking about lakshana before, right? And you may not remember, but we had various categories of lakshana. We started late. But there's another class? Okay, we'll stop. We'll stop because there's another class supposed to start at 11.
Yeah, well, we may finish this.
No, we'll continue. Oh. This is really into another topic. If I have to, unless we can go on for another 15 minutes, I can't probably explain it. Okay, and we have to stop to allow the next class to happen. All right, we'll continue. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jaya.